Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Micah Sargent and I speak with a number of awesome people. We talk about President Trump's war on social media and how that's about to escalate big time. Also, HBO Max, and how does its launch stack up against Disney Plus? We're finding out right now. Also, Instagram is giving creators tools to monetize their IGTV content. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 135, recorded Thursday, May 28th, 2020.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Do you have a domain name that truly represents you and your passion? Well, visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year.
And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/TNW.
Hello and welcome back to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent.
I am Jason Howell, and boy, are we starting with a doozy today.
This is going to be an interesting one. I've been stressed since yesterday. I hope that this helps me not be stressed about it. It's just, wow, let's do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's going to help with that, but there's still a lot we don't know. Top news today, to catch you up to speed, first of all, a few days back, President Trump tweeted out that mail-in ballots were, quote, substantially fraudulent. He was predicting a rigged election, so you know, the usual stuff. Soon after, Twitter actually slapped that tweet or that series of tweets with a fact-checking link. The first time that it's actually done so with a tweet coming from the president who's citing, let's just say, tenuous facts. Of course, Trump did not like that very much. So now there's high likelihood. In fact, it might just be imminent that we're going to see a signed executive order sometime today that aims to regulate social media, or at least inspire regulation of social media. Joining us is Emily Birnbaum from Protocol, who actually got her hands on a copy of the executive order late last night. She joins us now. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. It's our pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time. So let's start with Section 230, completely in the crosshairs here as far as what we know about this executive order. Why is Section 230 kind of historically important to where we are now? How might it actually change if Trump's arm get their way in this case?
So Section 230 is the law that allows social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook to make decisions about the kind of content that they have on their platform. So it both it allows them to avoid lawsuits for the kinds of things that people say, and it allows them to make their own decisions about how they want to deal with things like, you know, misinformation or fake news. And it is directly in the crosshairs because for years now, with increasing volume, conservatives have been calling Section 230 a quote unquote sweetheart deal. And, you know, they've said, why do these private companies have this special immunity that other businesses don't have? And so there have been a lot of conservatives who have really wanted to see the president, the administration, Congress take on Section 230 and maybe pare back some of those protections in response to allegations of anti-conservative bias online. So this is sort of like the fulfillment of their dreams, if ultimately it is signed by the president.
So what exactly in this executive order, and mind you, I should reiterate, like, it has not been issued at the time of this recording. It very well might happen before this podcast is released because it's expected sometime today on Thursday, May 28th. But what are the components of this executive order that directly threaten Section 230? Like, what do the mechanics of that look like?
So they had to do this very precarious legal dance to make sure that they're not overriding Congress in some way. So it essentially asks the Commerce Department to petition the FCC to issue a rulemaking, so to, you know, open up a review of Section 230 and consider, you know, whether companies are violating some of the provisions of Section 230 and whether they shouldn't be allowed to have that protection. So it opens up, it sort of empowers federal regulators to take a look at Section 230 and bypasses Congress, you know, by doing that. It also would gather together state attorneys general to look at allegations of anti-conservative bias to see if maybe they could bring their own suits according to the administration's interpretation of Section 230. And it would also instruct the FTC, which is another body that, you know, has some say over tech issues. It would instruct the FTC to look at some of these complaints and maybe bring some lawsuits according to, again, their interpretation of Section 230. So it would overall just empower a lot of different levers of government to review and, you know, potentially pare back these protections.
Okay. And now I know, based on, you know, reading through your article, the draft order also talks about pulling back ad spending on social platforms by these federal agencies. How much of an effect would something like that actually have on the platform? Or is that just kind of like an also like thumbing the nose at the social networks to say, see, bad company, so we're going to take our money and run?
I think it's both. I don't think it would, you know, by any means destroy, you know, any company's bottom line. But there is a recent government report that found federal agencies altogether spent $1.5 billion on advertising and PR over the last 10 years. And, you know, increasingly some of that is going to Facebook, it's going to Google. And, you know, they're oftentimes sort of like PSAs. You know, you can think about the census. The U.S. Census bought a lot of advertisements online in order to, you know, get out their message, increase participation. So those are the kinds of things that this would, you know, pull back. But it's an interesting provision that was not in previous versions of this executive order. And it seems, you know, according to a lot of legal experts that I've talked to today, that it's actually far more within the White House's purview to ask federal agencies to pull back spending like that. So it's interesting and probably largely symbolic.
Right. Yeah, it feels like a symbolic gesture as well. Now, one thing that I've definitely read a lot about as I've been following this story is the fact that it's easy to peg this as a you know, White House versus social media platform sort of thing. But the reality is that it's much wider than that, right? Like, this is essentially White House versus sites that differ in opinion or in belief of what, let's say, the administration is saying. If someone goes, if someone says, hey, you're citing something that is not a fact and we want to just merely let people know, whether that's a social media platform or whether that's a site that sells you know, clothes or whatever, that wants to put a banner on their site because they believe in something. I don't know what it could be, but essentially this would be a chilling effect for all websites if it were to go through, right? Like, this could really escalate more and more as we go along.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Section 230 is people have said that it enabled and continues to empower the modern internet. So it doesn't just help out websites like, you know, Twitter or Facebook. It also, you know, it enables Reddit, it enables Airbnb, it enables a lot of the websites that we rely on. But then, you know, the way the executive order is written, it would kind of put it in the hands of federal regulators to decide, you know, which companies they determine are violating provisions of Section 230. So, you know, some people have said it's sort of unlikely, if it even gets to this level, that federal regulators would want to take on, say, you know, Reddit or, you know, Airbnb or something like that. So it sort of sets an alarming precedent for those companies that rely on it. But I don't know if I would say that, you know, it's the end times for all of the internet.
It's easy to think that everything is the end times these days. We're just kind of in that frame of mind right now. It's hard to avoid. Mark Zuckerberg was on Fox News, I believe this was last night, saying that platforms like Facebook and Twitter shouldn't, quote, be the arbiter of truth of everything that people say online. And as I was reading that, you know, I was like, the question that popped up for me is whether that is a comment that adheres closely to Facebook's actions in this regard, or whether that's a comment that's meant to speak more as like a self-preservation sort of thing. And it's probably actually a little bit of both. What do you think as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think particularly Facebook, that's something Mark Zuckerberg has said before. He, you know, he's gotten criticism for saying that. It's something that Facebook says really drives its content moderation policies. I think he's saying it right now, and he's saying it on Fox News in order to curry some favor with the White House, because it sort of sets them apart from Twitter, which is in the middle of this, you know, war, this battle with the White House. But it's true that Facebook on the whole is more hands off, particularly when it comes to political speech, than Twitter. So you can just look at their political ad policies. You know, Twitter completely wiped political ads from their platform. Facebook continues to allow them, continues to allow politicians a wide breadth over, you know, what they can say. So it actually is a distinction between how these companies think about and treat speech online.
Yeah, and it's not even saying that Facebook doesn't have its own fact-checking system in place. They've had that for a while now. When I really look at the two companies and the like visceral reaction of Trump going, you know, reacting to what happened on Twitter versus Facebook, it seems to be just the mere fact that Trump actually relies on Twitter and posts on Twitter and kind of expects his, you know, whether he believes them to be true or not, his air quotes facts, to be able to reach as many people without any resistance. He does that actively with Twitter. He doesn't as actively on Facebook. I don't even know if President Trump has a Facebook account, but you never hear about that. It's always about Twitter. Yeah. Do you think that's kind of part of what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, he does use Facebook and his campaign uses Facebook, and like he does have a significant following, but he's the Twitter president. That's how he's been known since the beginning. He talks directly to people through Twitter. So indeed. I think, you know, he has actually posted some of the same stuff about mail-in ballots on Facebook, and Facebook said, oh, you know, we're hands off on this stuff. So there he is communicating some of the same messages across platforms, but Twitter just has this very special role in his presidency and how he imagines connecting with his base. And so I think that's why it's sort of like the perfect foil for him.
Yeah, it really does feel that way. Another way that it feels for me, it seems like it's a very convenient distraction. Obviously, the world is in a very interesting position right now. Health and well-being issues are top of mind for people as we're, you know, kind of working our way through, you know, what this whole coronavirus thing means and shelter in place. And people are either trusting that the shelter in place is, you know, with well-intentioned or not, going completely on the opposite side of that. Definitely this seems like a lightning rod for the Trump base as we head into the election. And I guess the question that I have about that is Twitter then, by placing this fact check label on President Trump's tweets, are they kind of playing into the hands, kind of playing that role for the administration that the administration actually wants right now? They want some sort of a distraction, and this is the perfect distraction from all the bad that's happening.
I mean, you could say it that way. You could tell the story that way. But you could also think about all of the enormous pressure that Twitter is facing from the other side. You know, Twitter and all these social media platforms have been accused of, you know, spreading misinformation, particularly around elections, spreading, you know, nonsense and debunked conspiracy theories about the virus itself. So they are responding to just a different set of pressures, and they're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place with this. And, you know, it was their decision to take a stand against the president. It was a bold thing to do. Some people have said that it was kind of stupid, but they are really sticking by it, and Jack Dorsey is sticking by it. And, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I even saw news today, like Twitter isn't slowing down on placing its fact check label on tweets. We're seeing a bunch of those today. So it really does seem like Jack Dorsey is saying, nope, this is the line, we've drawn it in the sand, and this is where we stand. So ultimately, that means that we're going to find out a whole lot, possibly today, like we said earlier, but definitely going forward. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this again on the show and definitely on the network in the coming weeks. And I'm sure you're going to be writing about it a lot as well. Emily Birnbaum, really appreciate you joining us. Emily writes for protocol.com. If people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
burnbomb_e on Twitter.
Right on. Thank you, Emily. Appreciate your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Best of luck.
Thanks so much. All right. Up next, HBO Max. What is it? Why is it? And how is it? But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. This is a vulnerable time for us, and we need each other more than ever. Stay in touch by creating a domain name that represents you. You can choose from over 400 domain name extensions when building your brand online. And no matter what you want to build, there's a domain name waiting for it. If you're an artist, Hover allows you to create a domain that showcases your talent with the extension .art. You can get a custom domain for each individual art piece that you create. .art can be used as a catalog where you can showcase each design with descriptions and details that people can view from all around the world. You get your creative juices flowing and you let Hover give you the stage for your art. I have several domains at Hover. In fact, anytime I want to buy a domain, Hover is the place that I go to get that domain. I know right now I've got sergeant.wiki. I've got mica.tech. I think I have mica.xyz. My website link page, chihuahua.coffee, I bought through Hover. Plus, I've got my eternal shame, which is slophie.net, but misspelled S-L-O-P-H-I-E, which is forever and always an embarrassing moment for me. Basically, if I think that I need to have a domain, whether it is logical or not, Hover is where I go to get that domain because they have the best tools, the best prices, it's fantastic. Genuinely, for the bottom of my heart, I love Hover and have used it for years, even before I ever talked about them as a sponsor on the show. For many entrepreneurs and artists, Hover is a jumping off point. They want you to start your business and display your talent with a domain name that truly showcases who you are. It's not hard to see why they are the popular choice for people starting all kinds of businesses or buying random domains. Hover gives you excellent technical support and is available to answer any questions you may have. And best of all, their support team doesn't upsell you. They work hard to help you get online. Hover has free Whois privacy protection, something a lot of other places are going to upsell you on, a clean and easy to navigate user experience and user interface, monthly sales on popular top-level domains. I think .io is one that I just saw was on sale. Keeping your domain name separate from hosting gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. That's a big deal. I may have a site that's created using Squarespace, but Hover is the place that I go to get my actual domain. So that way, if I decide to choose a different hosting platform or a different online service, it's easy to do because it's separate. Now, you can use a domain name that truly represents you and your passion. You just visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit. for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And thank you so much to Hover for your support.
I think I might be buying jasonhowell.tech based on your little recommendation there.
You must. Yes.
I missed out on jason.tech, but whatever.
Yeah, jasonhowell.tech is still very good. So I am excited to talk about today's topic. It was yesterday. I heard about this thing called HBO Max, and I went to my iPad, and I looked up HBO Max in the App Store, and I tapped to open it, and HBO Max popped up on my iPad, and then it said, it spit out some sort of error and said it was restarting. And so I tapped OK, and then it spit out the error again and pulled up the prompt. And then I tapped OK, and it basically just kept doing that. And I thought, I'm never going to actually get in to try this. But luckily, we have Jones Holzman here from CNET to tell us all about HBO Max. Joan, hello.
Hi. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, and we're so happy to have you here. You sound great. This is fantastic.
Well, I don't know if I can help troubleshoot your particular error, but I'll do my best to answer all your questions.
That sounds good. So first of all, let's talk about what HBO Max is, because there's HBO that, you know, people may have been used to as part of a cable package. There's HBO Go. I think there's HBO Now. And now we've got HBO Max. I mean, which one is this and what sets it apart from the others? What's going on, Max?
Well, maybe I'll go in chronological order. So in the beginning, there was HBO, home box office. That's the linear network, the traditional TV network, the premium network everybody is familiar with. And then as streaming became something that consumers were demanding, they introduced both HBO Go and HBO Now. And those are the two existing streaming options for HBO. HBO Go is the one that you get into if you pay for HBO with a traditional like cable service or other pay TV service. It's the what's called TV Everywhere thing where you sign in with those credentials that you are already paying for with your other TV networks. Then there's HBO Now. That was their standalone a la carte streaming option where you didn't have to have any other kind of bundle. You could just jump into HBO Now, get HBO itself streaming, and you could jump out whenever you wanted. Starting yesterday, now we have HBO Max, and this is HBO Warner Media / AT&T's. It's their bid at Netflix. It's their bid at Disney Plus. And what it does is it takes all of HBO that you're used to, all the movies, all the shows, and then it adds a bunch of other content to it. It adds things like Friends, a ton more movies, and exclusive originals like Netflix and Disney Plus have too. So that's what they're trying to do now, is to take, I guess, create one streaming service that rules them all, and that is HBO Max.
Ah, okay. So now the Max makes sense, that it's right. Supposed to be the big kahuna. Why? Do we know why HBO is deciding to launch this, given that the other services already existed and there are already so many other streaming services out there that it almost seems odd, or in theory, kind of a bad move to launch another streaming service that people have to potentially subscribe to? Do we know any of the business side of this, the point of it?
Yeah, one of the things that HBO knows it has to do is, you know, the reason there are all these services launching right now is because traditional media companies have realized they can't rely on that really lucrative cable environment to pay their way anymore. Cord cutting's happening. It's only getting more serious. It's only happening even more and more and more as every quarter goes on. And so these giant media companies and tech companies, they're land grabbing. They're launching these services to stake their claim, put up the walled garden, put up the walls around their garden of programming. And hopefully what they're hoping to do is be the one that gets to shape the future of TV. What it means for them business-wise, economically, it means that they have to struggle with these forces where their partnerships with pay TV providers are still really lucrative. HBO still gets a lot of money from people that subscribe to HBO through a pay TV service. What they've done by launching HBO Max is saying, okay, we're going to start being the person that has the direct relationship with the customer rather than that pay TV intermediary. And that creates tension. They're getting paid by the people that are now their competitors. And they have to work out these deals in order for people that are already paying for HBO through one of those regular TV services, for them to be able to get Max without having to pay extra for it. Because how frustrating would that be? Max costs basically the same as HBO, but if you're already paying for HBO and you haven't, and it's to somebody who hasn't struck a deal with HBO, you don't get Max. You're paying the same amount as everybody else, but you're not getting double the content. So there's a lot of confusion, I think, for consumers trying to figure out, wait, what is this? What do I get? And do I need to pay any more? And there's a lot of complexity on the back end, on the economic side, too.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of like, so there's a sort of comparison that you've established that I think is a really good one, by talking about the fact that HBO Max has Elmo on it, and that you know, that it is using similar offerings to some of the other services out there to try and entice people. So you feel that HBO Max is like what streaming service?
It's similar to Netflix and Disney Plus. It's most similar to those in that those are streaming services with gigantic catalogs. Probably most similar to Disney Plus because, unlike Netflix, you know, Netflix, they're cranking out new content every day. Netflix relies much more on having fresh new things for you to watch versus Disney and now HBO Max, which are relying more on a back catalog. The fact that they have decades of history. In the case of HBO Max, yes, you've got HBO, but you also have everything from Warner Brothers. So you've got DC stuff, you've got classic movies, you've got Turner classic movies stuff, you've got Wizard of Oz, Citizen Kane, you've got this really deep catalog to lean back on. And that's why I think HBO Max is really positioning itself based on those franchises that you recognize, rather than, you know, Disney Plus had a gigantic catalog that spans decades, but they also had The Mandalorian, which was like one of the most anticipated TV shows of last year. And that worked out well for them. Baby Yoda was a big deal. HBO Max doesn't really have that. They're not really trying to replicate that. And if they are, they didn't have it available, you know, at the bang at the start, maybe, you know, partially probably because of COVID-19 and all these things that have caused disruptions. But for consumers, if you're trying to figure out what the heck am I getting into, think of it as being like Disney Plus. It's just instead of Star Wars, you get DC. Instead of Marvel, you get Ghibli. Instead of Pixar, you get Studio Ghibli. So it's a difference in the content, but the kind of quality of the content and the idea of the content is the same.
Yeah, especially that last one. That's one that has me really interested in it. I have seen many of those films. Spirited Away is one of my favorites, but haven't watched all of them. And it's nice to have that there. I'd mentioned earlier the issues that I had. Have you seen, you wrote this article, or it was published rather yesterday, as of today, that would be May 27th was yesterday. And have you seen any conversation about people having issues accessing it? I can remember when Disney Plus first launched, there were some errors because everybody was trying to get on it and use it. But it basically took the HBO app that I already had on my device and changed its name to HBO Max and then updated it. And so I was a little surprised that I was having trouble accessing the site, given the fact that I already had or that they, you know, they'd already been using it as HBO Now up to this point. So I'm just curious if in the outcome after the article, if you saw any other reports of people having trouble accessing the service.
Yeah, certainly no levels of disruption like Disney Plus. So if you recall back to that day, the service was crashing. People were having trouble signing up. They were having trouble getting in, and then once they were in, they had trouble speaking like I am now. They had trouble streaming the content that they wanted to watch. That was partly a reflection of the fact that it was a brand new service in this country and the other countries that it was launching in, except for the Netherlands. And then, you know, to HBO's credit, there's no better test case for delivering something streaming at scale than having been the place where you stream Game of Thrones every Sunday night when it was the cultural event every week for 2 months last year. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I guess 2 years ago. So HBO has gotten to the point where they know how to deliver streams when it is in a very compressed period of time. Lots of people want the exact same content within like a start time where all the starts are between like a 15-minute window. So HBO knows how to handle that kind of capacity. The flip side is, you know, when you have crashes like Disney Plus did, one of the reasons it's a bad thing, but there's a good reason for it. It's because there's so much demand. And that was the case with Disney Plus. There was just so much demand to get that app, to start watching things. And from what we can tell from the amount of downloads that there have been to the new HBO Max app, the amount of updates like you had where the HBO Now app did by a automatic software update turned into HBO Max. And also from things like Google Trends, we can see that there's not nearly the amount of interest yesterday on the HBO Max launch day as there was for Disney Plus on its launch day. So you have sort of two things going on. We don't see nearly as many disruptions. That's to HBO's credit and the fact that they know how to handle a lot of demand. It's also, you know, a little bit of a not a criticism, but it makes you question whether or not the demand wasn't as strong, and so therefore they didn't have as much of a challenge to overcome.
We talked a little bit about kind of the impact of what we're going through right now, the coronavirus, and, you know, launching a service. You know, Quibi had to deal with this, and now HBO Max is about to kind of deal with this as well, how the coronavirus is going to affect the launch of their service. The question that I have is kind of about all these streaming services in general. Let's say 6, 8, 10 months down the line, production schedules always take a while, you know, to kind of build up and collect that content. And they know that they're going to be releasing it at X time. Do you think that we're going to hit a point, you know, 8, 10 months down the line where there would have been, if the coronavirus hadn't happened, content to make these services even more impactful in how they dominate the landscape, let's say. But maybe there's less appeal for people because that production time is missing for 2, 3, 4 months stretch.
Yeah, these are really interesting differences between these services. Netflix, you know, the Netflix model where you release all the episodes of a season at once, who would have thought that that would be such a crucial aspect to dealing with a COVID-19 pandemic? Because they release everything at once, it means they start their productions much further out, earlier in advance than a traditional television show that's released week to week does. And so they have more stuff in their pipeline that's at a level where it can go into post-production. It doesn't have to be disrupted by the shoot, because it's really the production shooting element of live action stuff that's really being disrupted here. Netflix is in a really strong position. They've said that they're having no disruptions to the release, like basically, like maybe minuscule percentage disruption to what they plan to release all the way through this year and well into next year. Now, services like Disney Plus and like HBO Max, they've indicated that, you know, their plans are mostly going to stick with what they should be through the summer, through the fall, maybe if they're lucky, pushing into the winter and getting into next year. But next year, they're going to have to, if we haven't been able to come back and start shooting things, then they're going to have to start getting creative about how to continue to have new, fresh content if that's something they want to rely on in drawing in interest. Because, you know, like I said, they can always, they have the like 10,000 hours or whatever it is of movies. They have plenty for people to watch there. It's just a matter of if they want to have those new originals to be the thing that keep drawing people in, keep getting them to come back to the app and get back to the service. And more, maybe even most importantly, have there be word of mouth, have people chattering and talking about it so new people get interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I am going to keep an eye on whether I can eventually access this and see some of these shows for myself. But I guess we'll find out. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. Of course, we can read your awesome work over on CNET.com. But if people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter. I'd love to hear people's questions and reactions. I'm at @Joan_E on Twitter and would love to hear what people's thoughts are on HBO Max and if they're having trouble with it, like you are.
Thank you. Beautiful. All right. Thanks so much.
We'll talk to you soon. All right. Coming up, changes to Instagram that are actually going to help creators monetize themselves even better on the platform, more effectively anyways. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. 91% of all cyber attacks start in email. So spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many people you have working for your company times how many emails that they're receiving. And you see quickly that one click on the wrong email, which is a high likelihood of happening, can cost you money, it can cost you customers, and it can cost you your reputation. Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of 667%. In this type of attack since the end of February. So you can get the protection that you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes a number of things. You get all-in-one email security, backup, and archiving. You get AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise. There's an automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. You also get security awareness training so you can educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. And I mean, there's just a number of ways how this is playing out. Right now, there are new attacks that are actually impersonating organizations like the World Health Organization. Attackers are utilizing domain spoofing, and they're promising information relating to the coronavirus, of course, in an attempt to trick users into a phishing scam. And that's just one example of a way that Barracuda can actually be inserted into this scenario and help you, help your company avoid this sort of thing. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account, risk-free, at barracuda.com/TNW. That's barracuda.com/TNW. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support. All right, Instagram is making some changes that are going to make creators using the platform very happy. Joining us to talk about some of the monetization enhancements that are hitting Instagram is Ashley Carman from The Verge. Welcome back to the show, Ashley.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to get you back. We appreciate your time. So let's start with how this is going to work exactly. How are ads going to appear? This is all tied into IGTV, of course. What are those ads like going to look like from a rev share perspective for creators using the platform? And what have they been doing prior to this? Because we know people have been making money on Instagram.
Yeah. So to kind of think about how influencers were making money on Instagram before, you basically have to think about it as like the Wild West. Instagram did not want any part in monetization. They kind of left the influencers to do their own thing. So that's how you ended up with really sometimes controversial merch and different products, things like that, that influencers would kind of hawk or come up with their own deals. And now we're seeing Instagram finally start saying, okay, we're going to take a more firm role in this. And that means ads are coming to IGTV. They're working with a limited number of partners, and they're saying it's an industry standard rev share, meaning that influencers slash partners will receive 55% of the revenue.
Not bad. So in order to qualify for this, of course, Instagram has some requirements for creators. And like you said, eventually this is going to open up to more and more people. Right now it's limited. But when this does open up, and for the people who are in on this now, what do they need to keep in mind when they're creating for this platform to make sure that they can actually benefit from this monetization?
Yeah. So what I noticed is with the partners that they're working with, they're saying it's around 200 approved influencers slash creators right now. These are kind of the people who I've heard just covering the space for years now that they've sort of, I don't want to say groomed, but the people that they've really worked closely with. So these are people they trust, they know are probably not going to do anything outlandish. And I imagine they're only going to be working with approved partners for quite a while. But even these partners have to be aware of what they're posting. So Instagram has its general policy around what you can post, but they also now have a monetization policy, which is different. So for example, an influencer could swear in a video that they post to IGTV normally, and there's no problem with that. But if they want to monetize that video, they're not going to be allowed to swear. So they're going to have to kind of tailor their messages to be pretty brand friendly.
And do they make that decision? So I guess I'm thinking about how this works from an action standpoint. Are the creators creating the content and then Instagram reviews the content to make sure they're not swearing to follow that example? Or are the creators saying, hey, I didn't swear in here, it's cool, go ahead and give me some money? How does that work?
So right, yeah. So this is a really important question because YouTube has run into issues with this, with their monetization, and Instagram now doing this much later in the game has a high bar. If they want to lure some advertisers over from, let's say, YouTube, they have to guarantee to these advertisers that their ads are only going to show up in front of videos that are brand safe. Right now, they're using humans to review every video that comes up and is monetizable. But in the future, they're hoping it's a combination of humans and software that are able to review every video, which is a tall order because, again, We've seen this play out with YouTube. Sometimes controversies arise that have nothing to do with the content itself, but actually commenters' behavior. So they're going to have to start really policing in different ways, and we'll have to see if Instagram can do that effectively.
Yeah, indeed. Now, this is not the only way that that Instagram is allowing creators to kind of monetize officially through the platform. There's also badges, which, I mean, it definitely has, you know, correlates to some features on other platforms. But talk a little bit about how badges work for creators on Instagram Instagram TV.
So badges are for Instagram Live. They're not for IGTV. So Instagram Live is all the live broadcasts you've probably seen become really popular during the pandemic. And really what it is viewers can purchase badges as they're watching. And each, there's three different levels, one for 99 cents, $1.99, and $4.99. They all have a different visual appearance. And buying those badges allows these viewers / commenters to show up higher in the comments and be prioritized. So they kind of get to show off and comment, and more people are going to see it. And also the creator who's hosting the broadcast can sort of shout them out because they'll be able to see who bought badges.
Oh, so that's very Twitch-like, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that case right now, it's just a test. But in that case, there's no rev share happening yet, but the company says eventually it's going to be a rev share and not just keeping the cash.
Someone in our chat room brought up an interesting question that I hadn't considered. Instagram is keeping 45% of their revenue share here. The creators keeping 55%. How does that stack up to some of the other platforms out there? Is that industry standard? Is that a lot going more by comparison going to Instagram, the platform?
Yeah. So, I mean, if for Instagram, I mean, this is the first time they're doing it. And Facebook has actually been doing 55% for Facebook Watch has been doing it. I'm not actually entirely sure what YouTube shares with them. I think that it's about the same. So, I mean, I'm sure that people would love to be able to negotiate that rate, but I have a feeling it's pretty set.
Yeah, I'm just doing a quick search here, and I think it's a 45-55 split as far as that's concerned, too. So, so it sounds like it's actually pretty much in line by comparison. Mm-hmm. Now, why did Instagram hold out for as long as it seems like they have as far as this is concerned? There have been creators on the platform making money, like you said, Wild Wild West prior. So they've been figuring it out. Other platforms have been really, really quick to do this because they know that it makes their platform more attractive to creators. And I guess it's, you know, it'd be, I don't know, Instagram isn't hurting in some ways, but I don't know how IGTV necessarily compares to some of the other competitors. Perhaps this rev share, you know, this vacant rev share for so long could be a reason that Instagram might be behind others. Is that a fair question to ask?
I mean, I think it's a fair question to ask why they haven't been doing this for as many years as they've been around. And you know, I'm not totally sure. Of course, Instagram was acquired by Facebook. So I'm sure Facebook eventually knew that they would want to use ads on the platform. And there are ads on Instagram that is just solely ad money for Facebook. But I imagine, you know, they had to launch a product like IGTV in order to do the revenue share with the creators, because revenue share for stories doesn't really make sense. Like, they run the ads before stories and that's just them doing automated work there. But IGTV is the new long form section of the app. So I think that before they could even get to the monetization point, they had to build up that section, get creators used to posting there, figure out who might be ideal there. And now they're kind of wading in and seeing how it goes. But it's a big undertaking, again, from this sort of moderation standpoint.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like you said, they want to be sure that the people that they're kind of allowing into this exclusive room, that there's some history there. There's some reason to believe that it's going to work so that it continues to work as they open it up. And along those lines, do we have any indication as far as when Instagram might be thinking about it in short or long term for opening this up? Obviously, it's early because they just started this. But have they given any indication like by the end of the year, we plan to open it up, or is it just sometime in the future?
I did ask, and they really did not give a timeline. They were like, well, we'll see how it goes. So I could not get a timeline out of them.
Yeah. Well, these things usually take months. So if you're waiting for something like this, I guess that just means you continue doing what you're doing, continue living in the wild, wild west until the opportunity comes your way. And you haven't really lost out on anything that way. Ashley Carman from The Verge, thank you so much for hopping on with us today. If people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
I'm at Ashley R. Carman on Twitter and at Ashley Carman on Instagram.
Right on, Ashley. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Stay safe.
All right, you too. Bye, Ashley. All right. Meaty stories, but I think we are we're at the end.
We have reached the end.
This is the end, my only friend, until next week.
Now, Tech News Weekly
Sorry.
That was what I was going to ask you. When does Tech News Weekly publish?
Normally Thursdays, but next week, Thursday, because that's when we normally publish. So, you know, was that confusing?
That was yes. I'm not even going to play along. That was very confusing.
Yeah, sorry. No, we publish each and every Thursday. Nothing's changed as far as that's concerned. So check out our site at twit.tv/TNW. And you can find ways to subscribe to this show in audio and video formats. And then it doesn't matter when we subscribe, because no matter what, you're always going to have the latest episode automatically through the magic of RSS and podcast.
Yes. And if you would like to be a part of this wild and wacky show with a particularly wild and wacky bent this week, you can email us at tnw@twit.tv. And of course, follow Twit on social media. It's at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram. Oh, badges. Who knows? And at Twit Talk on TikTok. Of course, if you want to tweet at me or follow me on social media, I'm pretty much at Micah Sargent on everything. Or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, however, chihuahua.coffee, where it's got links to all the things I do. Later today, I am talking about, I get sleep science-y and I get techie in this episode of Hands on iOS that'll be published later today. And it was like a dream come true, because I love talking about sleep and the science that surrounds it. What about you, Jason?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Jason Howell. And then if you want to check out one of my other shows that published just this morning, Hands on Android, go to twit.tv/HOA. The episode that we did this week is Advanced Assistant. So if you like Assistant and some of the commands that you can do on your smartphone with Assistant, I tried to find some features about Assistant that maybe you haven't heard of, or maybe are a little less known or very powerful that I like. So outside of the usual set alarm for that sort of stuff, some really interesting stuff there. twit.tv/HOA. And thanks to everyone at the studio who help us do the show each and every week. Of course, John is pushing the buttons. He also happens to turn around, you know, produce, edit, and turn around Hands on Android and Hands on iOS.
Every show, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Thursday is a big day for John. So thank you, John. Also, thanks to Burke. John's somewhere there in the dark room wearing a mask. Thanks to Burke, the studio engineer, for helping get everything together as well. And thanks to you for watching and listening each and every week. We'll see you next week. I promise, next Thursday on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Don't make promises. Goodbye.
Don't promise.
Be sure to check out the other shows on the network, like my other show, Hands On Wellness. I love to share different tips and tricks that's going to help you get a better grasp on your personal wellness. Just go to twit.tv/how and subscribe now.